in what the magazine reported as a surge of first-time female candidates. Neubauer's image can be seen behind the E in Time. Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. The NBA last night, the Bucks over the 76ers, 107-95. The Bulls were off. Both teams are off tonight. NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They skate in Nashville tonight. Now, the forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, the 30th, should be sunny, breezy, and seasonal, a high of 29, 25 overnight, 43 for Wednesday. This morning, wind from the west-northwest at 6, 11 degrees Racine, 12 Kenosha, wind chill 4 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, it is not every day that I get to say these words. My guest on the morning show is the certified personal trainer of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But that indeed is the case. My guest is Bryant Johnson, and he works with Justice Ginsburg on a very regular basis and has done so since 1999. The two of them first became connected after she underwent surgery for colorectal cancer. And after a battery of chemotherapy and radiation, it was Justice Ginsburg's husband who said that she should seek out a personal trainer to build back her strength. And that personal trainer turned out to be Bryant Johnson, who has actually quite a number of federal court justices, judges, attorneys, and clerks, and so on, as clients. He has recently put together a book with the blessing of Justice Ginsburg called the RBG Workout, in which we are taken through the workouts which he does with the Supreme Court Justice on a regular basis, with certain suggestions on how one might do these very exercises at home, and especially if you don't have certain exercise equipment, ways in which the exercises in effect can still be done, and lots of other wonderful little bits of information along the way. It's a great little book published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again called the RBG Workout, and of course RBG refers to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Bryant Johnson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg, for having me. I really appreciate it, and thank you for your listeners also.
I think I neglected to say in the introduction that you are actually yourself a court clerk, and that is one of the reasons why it was so easy for you to connect with Justice Ginsburg and other people in the Justice Department. And we'll talk more about that relationship in just a moment. I wonder if you could say a word about where you come from originally and some of the people who have been important in your life, and maybe along the way as you're talking about your early life, maybe you can also make mention of your high school graduating class from 1982 from Rappahannock High School, because you make special mention of that in your acknowledgments as being one of the factors that really shaped who you are.
Well, first of all, Greg, I am a records manager here at the United States District Court, and I was born in New Jersey, but I was raised in a little town called Warsaw, Virginia. I raised with my grandmother, grandfather, and several aunts and uncles who lived nearby. So I was raised by a village. I talk about Rappahannock High School because it really wasn't until maybe three or four class reunions, actually two class reunions ago, I was talking, you know, to members of my class, and I was telling them how I am so appreciative to have gone to a public school in the country. And the reason why I use that is because in the country, your options are very limited. Unless your family is filthy, filthy rich and you can send your child to a very private school someplace else, everyone is going to that same public school in the country. And by going to that same public school in the country, you're exposed to many different varieties of people. Well, it wasn't until I made that statement at the class reunion that one of my classmates told me that we were the first, one of the first K through 12 integrated classes in Richmond County, Virginia. And I said, no way, you have proof of that. So he sent me a link, sent me an email, and it was. But what was fascinating to me was is that I had no idea. My entire time going through school, we weren't treated any differently. You know, if the teachers didn't like us, just didn't like us. If you did good, you did good. If you did bad, you did bad. There was no sign of any type of favoritism. And as a result of that, and then joining the military, which is probably the greatest melting pot of all time, you are around so many different types of people and different cultures and different races. And now in the military, I'm also now an equal opportunity advisor. And that job requires me to talk to soldiers who feel that they've been discriminated against because of race, religion, color, gender, national origin, and sexual preference. So all of this has come around full circle so that I am able to train and work with anybody from any walk of life. And so training Justice Ginsburg just kind of completed the circle, I guess you could say.
Explain exactly how and when, under what circumstances, physical training became so important, first of all, for you, for your own body.
Well, always in the country growing up, and at the time that I was growing up, you know, you always played outside. It was never too hot, never too cold. Matter of fact, you stayed outside just so you didn't have to do chores in the house. Played basketball, high school, ran track. Wasn't until I really joined the military. When I joined the military, and then, of course, I was in a special forces unit, and we were also jumping out of airplanes and helicopters and hitting the ground and bouncing. And so at that moment, I realized, well, if I'm going to put my body through this, I need to make sure that my body is in the best possible shape I can do. And it also helped that one of my aunts had this fantastic pound cake that I was my weakness. And so I figured if I'm going to eat the way that I want to eat, I need to make sure that I work out so that I can eat what I want when I want.
Mm-hmm. You know, it occurs to me that when you are leading the training of someone like Justice Ginsburg or other judges and attorneys and so on, you probably by and large are working with people whose professional lives are at least largely spent in very sedentary fashion behind desks or at tables. But you are not a personal trainer for ditch diggers and telephone pole climbers and so on. I mean, you are working with people who, in a sense, probably really have an acute need for what you offer them.
Yes, I agree with you, but if you really think about it, modern technology has really made it worse for us because many things that we used to do, even if you look at something as simple as a TV, I grew up, I remember we had three, four channels, maybe five. Now we have 340 channels. You got a remote control. You're looking for the remote more so than just getting up and turning the channel. Simple chores that we used to do that we have to get up and move and do, you can do just sitting down and just clicking this, clicking that, and you can do everything without even moving. So as great as technology has become, it also has become our crutch. But on the flip side, technology has also made it so that you can now monitor your exercise. You can put on something like a Fitbit, for example, and let you know how many steps. You'd be like, you know what? I need to start doing more steps. So it's six and one and a half a dozen the other, but for the question here, yes, we are, a lot of the judges, a lot of the staff at the court, we do a lot of sitting all day. And so to engage them, to get them up, moving around, is definitely one of the most important things that I think I play in their lives.
What was it like to have this opportunity cross your path to work with somebody of the stature of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg? I mean, how intimidating was that? And for instance, your very first meeting, what did that feel like?
The very first meeting, it was, I guess the nerves were only just getting to the Supreme Court, making sure that I was at the right location. Once I met the justice, I quickly went from in awe of the person to personal trainer and how can I help this person help herself. That is really quickly it. I respect all of the clients that I have. I respect the title. I respect who they are. But that has nothing to do with the personal training and the reason why they called me. They called me to try to help them to help themselves. So it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, what position you hold, a plank, a crunch, a squat, a push-up, doesn't matter who you are. And so my job is to try to help them to help themselves and get past the awe of who they are. They know who they are. I respect who they are, but still treat them like a person.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Bryant Johnson, the certified personal trainer of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And we are talking about his new book called The RBG Workout, which he wrote with her blessing. As a matter of fact, there is a foreword written by Justice Ginsburg herself. At one point, you say the justice, meaning Justice Ginsburg, is a cyborg. She is a machine. What exactly do you mean by that? And to what extent is that a help? And to what extent is that maybe a risk factor when it comes to her physical regimen?
When I go cyborg, I'm actually really referring to the movie Terminator, where Arnold Schwarzenegger was this cyborg that just kept coming, you know, kept coming. Whatever you put it up against, it kept coming. And when I say this with Justice Ginsburg, her tenacity, her commitment to excellence, her commitment to doing her job, her commitment to her health now, when she can have an hour of sleep, but she will still show up. When we are scheduled to train, it's very rare that she will cancel. Matter of fact, I think I may cancel before she will cancel. And it's a commitment. She realized it early on that the exercise has played a vital part in her well-being, her health. Her bone density has increased. And so I use cyborg in a way that to let you know that she doesn't use an excuse. Whenever I say I'm going to do this, this, and this, she never says the word can't, because that's a four-letter word that I don't like any client to use with me. You can use any other word except for that word can't. It can also be her crutch, because she will show up. And sometimes I have to protect the justice from herself. So if she may have an injury, but I still want to work out. Okay, Justice, let's take it easy. Well, no, I want to work out. So now I have to be creative in how I may take it easy on her workout without her realizing that I'm taking it easy. So at that time, you know, it's her moving, driving force, but at the same time, me as a trainer, I am here to help the person help themselves, and I also sometimes have to protect them from themselves.
Right, and it's so interesting to think about how somebody doing the work that you do, how sometimes you have a dynamo like Justice Ginsburg, whom you probably have to, more than anything, sort of restrain or make sure they don't push themselves too hard. And then there, you probably have other clients where maybe it's the opposite, and you need to be cajoling them, encouraging them to do more than they realize they can. There's a lot of psychology involved in this work, isn't it?
There's more psychology than people realize. And when I've talked to people who want to become personal trainers and people who are personal trainers and they may ask my opinion, I said the biggest thing you have to realize is lots of times you are that therapy for that person. You're that sounding board. Sometimes that person may talk about things that they don't feel they want to talk about with anybody else. You have to judge that person for what that person is at that particular moment. And so what I always say is I do a AAA process with each client every time. So it's assess, adjust, and I adapt, which means When I greet them, I assess what's going on. Hey, Justice, how are you today? She may say, hey, I've only had an hour sleep. Okay, that's my assessment. Now, from assessing that, I'm going to adjust my workout according to that assessment. Then as we're going through the workout, if she's responding well or responding slow, I may have to adapt the workout according to how she's going. And that's what I do with every client. So it's not about me, the client. Me, the trainer, is what I tell people. It's not about you. Even though they may have come to you because you are the trainer, you got to quickly remember it's never about you. It's about them. If they didn't feel they got a good workout, then it reflects on you. Mm. If the workout was awesome, then guess what? That reflects on you also. If they get hurt, that's on you. So while they're with you, it is your responsibility to treat them like that property, that special gift that is to you, because they are, at some point, they are relinquishing some power to you.
Mm.
And you now have control over that, and they trust you to take care of them. And you have to really take that literally and seriously, and I do that with every client. It can be draining because you are putting your energy and your focus into that client for that time period. Then once you're done, you switch that off, and then you go switch to the next one.
Yeah. What is interesting, of course, with Justice Ginsburg's personal story is, as I already mentioned, your professional relationship with her as a trainer began after she was recovering from colorectal cancer surgery. But then 10 years later, she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and so suffered yet another very serious physical setback. Just talk for a moment about the kind of challenges that you faced as her trainer in trying to figure out the very best way to work with her in the wake of something that physically was so devastating. What does a trainer look for or think about in making the wisest choices for their client under those kind of difficult circumstances?
With me, it started off with the communication. Me and the Justice talked about it. Then me, I don't know everything, but I know somebody that knows something about it. And so as a trainer, not being afraid to reach out to somebody, says, hey, I have a client with this ailment. This is what's going on with this client. This is what I'm thinking. Is there anything that you can suggest or something? Because I've done that. I've reached out to some of my clients, reached out to some of my fellow personal trainers who may have more experience in certain areas than I have. Okay, so I know the basis that I want to do, but I may want to have a sounding board. And I actually thank one of my personal trainers in my book. I thank her because she's like a sounding board for me, because she may have dealt with clients that are more – may have more challenges than some of the clients that I have had. And so I had some ideas on what I was thinking, and I just wanted to, you know, talk it over with somebody. So this is what I'm thinking, and this is what my philosophy in going about this. How do you think, or what do you think? And they may give me, yeah, also consider this. Yes, maybe no, consider that. And so as a personal trainer, just being able to reach out and have a network of people that you can go to get advice from, because the end result is still, it's about the client.
Hmm.
That's what it's about.
Of course. A couple nuts and bolts things before we finish up. One of the things you have sometimes done with Justice Ginsburg involves what you call funny counting. Can you please explain to our listeners the kind of funny counting that is sometimes part of these workouts?
It's my way of pushing my client sometimes without my client knowing. So she'll be doing something, and I see that she's doing pretty good with it, and I want to push her some more. And then I'll be like, she may be at number 8, and I'll be like, okay, I need like 4 more. Or whenever they ask me, how many more do I have? 2. Now, it takes a while for my clients to realize that every time that you ask me, how many more you have to do, it's always going to be 2 more. Always. And if she's tired, or if my client is not doing this form correctly, or their energy is just not there, you know what? I may just cut the number down, you know? Just give me 2 more. All right, good. That's it. So it's just assessing that workout while you're doing it. You know, you in your mind, you have what you want to do. But it can't be so etched in stone that you can't move, adjust, and adapt your workout as you're going along with your client. And so that's how I do it. If she has more energy on one, I may have her do a little bit extra. Sometimes when she's in the plank position, I'll push her just to try to throw her stability off to see if she can hold it. You know, I may count funnier with, you know, my cadence may be 30, 29, 28, or I may go 30, 29, 28, 27, 26. You know, I can speed it up, slow it down, just to push them on how they're responding to the workout.
So how has she done over the course of 18 years now, for the most part, that you have worked with her? I mean, what is she like today versus that very first occasion on which you did a training workout with her?
She is committed to the exercise, but a similar question someone had asked me, and I hadn't thought about it until, you know, now. And when they asked me, they said, well, what is it that she can't do before, or if I've had to adjust early on now between these 18 years? And I thought about it, and I actually was talking to the justice about that. I said, Justice, do you realize that I train you harder now as you've gotten older than I did when we first started? And the funny thing was, the justice was thinking about it, and she didn't really give me that much of a reaction because she just wasn't in that zone yet. And I said, well, let's, for example, Justice, remember I used to have you do crunches. I said, now I don't have you do crunches. Now I have you do planks. I have you do planks on the side, and I push on you, and I make it a little more harder for you. And she thought about it. She's like, huh. Then we used to do a move where I had her lay on her back, put her legs up, and I would, like, lay across her leg. It would be like a version of a leg press, except she would be leg pressing my weight. And I changed that to, once her bone density increased, I changed that to doing one-legged squats. Or another version would be like a pistol squat, but I'm actually holding her. She's holding my hand, and she's squatting down with one leg and standing up. And that became more challenging to her. And I told her that we changed from doing that to this. And once I gave her those two examples, she thought about it. She's like, huh. Like, and, oh, that's good. I am stronger. So, but just not realizing, we train is just like news hours on. There's very little conversation except for me saying, two more, 30 seconds, this exercise, do this. Moving here, I'll touch her hand. She knows to take it off. I move this. You know, I mimic the exercise. She goes to it. So it's almost like we are almost on autopilot. And she doesn't move any of the weights, so I control the weights. So she doesn't know what weight I put in. I could put 40 on there today, and I could put 80 on there the next day. Has no idea. I put the weight on it, then I control the weight by holding the machine and going through it, and I can take some of the pressure on and take some and put some more pressure on. So that's how I do it with her.
Wow. We want to remind everyone that the book takes us through just about all of the various exercises that you do with Justice Ginsburg, and it's complete with illustrations in which we are, in a sense, seeing her hard at work. And there are also all kinds of points in the book in which you explain how people can do these exercises even at home without any so-called exercise equipment available at all. In other words, there is no excuse whatsoever for not making use of some of this. Of course, one of the realities of this kind of exercise training is that it's important that it is done with a trainer who is making wise choices for you specifically and your own situation. So how do you advise somebody who buys your book to make the wisest use of it at home? I mean, is it safe and advisable for them to just do the things that are pictured here? How can people use this book most effectively and safely?
Well, as with anything, if you're about to embark on exercise, it's always good to check with your doctor and make sure that you don't have any ailments. If you know a personal trainer, or if you have access to a gym, you know, you could take that book there. Some gyms, you know, they have a personal trainer that you can get, like, free for, like, the first time or the second time. Well, you know, take the book there. The book is small. It's, you know, about 5x7. It's bright yellow. It covers a lot of the basic exercises and the basic muscle groups. The great thing about exercise is that there isn't really, there's so much of a change that I'm just covering certain basic things, and everything is built on a foundation. Here are foundations of various exercises that are in this book. You can take it. You can use machines at the gym. You can have the trainer go with you, go through it. Awesome. If you don't want to do it at a gym, you can also do it at home. All you need is a resistance tube. You can get those maybe $5, $10. I suggest getting maybe two or three small, light, medium, and heavy, and get a door anchor. And then you can mimic just about every exercise that you can use as a machine. But the biggest thing is that it's a functional book. These are functional exercises. So when I have her sit down and stand up, that's the one exercise I tell the Justice. Justice, if you can't do this exercise, you're going to need a nurse 24/7. And sitting down and standing up is just like going to the bathroom, sitting down, and standing up. The moment you can't do that, you're going to need somebody to monitor you 24/7. You take it easy. Take it slow. There are options in this book. It's all about having options. If one doesn't work, then try something else.
And we should mention that, right, and it's not just the alternatives in terms of if you aren't at an exercise club or don't have the equipment, but also easier alternatives are often presented. For instance, different kinds of push-ups. If regular push-ups would be a little bit much for you, there are easier alternatives that might make more sense. It really does give one a lot to think about. And of course, the most important thing is to get started. Do something. And one way to begin is by taking this wonderful book in hand called The RBG Workout. And it's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and the author, Bryant Johnson. Bryant Johnson, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I really enjoyed looking at your book. It has been an inspiration to me, and I hope it will be for many, many people. And best wishes to you and to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Greg, thank you so much, and thank you for your listeners. I appreciate it. Also, if you're looking to get the book or any other questions, you can go to the website, and that's easy. It's www.rbgworkout.com.
Very good. The time is 8:37. You are listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two from the Morning Show archives. I hold in my hands a beautiful book from National Geographic, and in some ways I'm sort of holding the whole universe in my hands, which is quite an interesting experience. The reason is that this book has quite an ambitious scope to it. It's called Sizing Up the Universe, The Cosmos in Perspective. And the author of the book, co-author, Richard Gott III, professor of astrophysics at Princeton University, has tried to help us understand the scope of the universe, just how large it is, how large important bodies in the universe are, how far they are apart from each other, and trying to help us grasp all this beyond the mere numbers, which after a while utterly overwhelm us. And so it is a lesson in trying to give us perspective on the immensity of the universe. And along the way, we are also treated to absolutely gorgeous photographs of jaw-dropping beauty. And so I'm so excited for this opportunity to speak with Professor Gott about this book, again called Sizing Up the Universe, The Cosmos in Perspective, which comes to us from National Geographic. Professor Gott, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Looking forward to talking to you very much. I have to say right off the bat, one of the things I especially enjoyed was something you say, I believe, in the book's introduction about how, in many cases, children are drawn to astronomy the same way they're often drawn to dinosaurs, because of the fact that kids love big things, and it and not much is bigger than the universe itself. I guess nothing is.
That's right. When I got interested in astronomy when I was 8 years old, and I was interested in the planets. Things in astronomy are even bigger than dinosaurs. So I got interested in astronomy.
And I guess what I really appreciate, too, is that when you first study astronomy, you're studying things like the order of the planets and the satellites revolving around them and eventually things like our galaxy and so on. But, boy, when you seriously study astronomy, you get away from some of that tangibility pretty quickly. And it becomes, in some ways, what at least feels like a much different science, a much different discipline than the more basic astronomy where we all begin. And I love the fact that your book really in so many ways is content with astronomy in a sense at its most basic, at its most accessible level for as complex and mind-blowing as a lot of this is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yes. We start out by showing, you know, how big things look in the sky, how the ancient Greeks figured out, you know, how big the moon was, how big the sun was, how far away things are. And this has been steady progress over the centuries. Hubble discovered that there were other galaxies, that they were very far away. To give you an idea, if we shrink the Earth in size by a factor of a billion, we're all familiar with a billion, you know, a dollar will get you a hamburger, $1 billion makes you a billionaire. If you shrink by a factor of a billion the Earth, it will be as large as a marble. So if you have the Earth as large as a marble, the sun is a giant beach ball, 55 inches across, over 500, about 500 feet away. That's more than the length of a football field. And the nearest star on that scale is Proxima Centauri, which is about the size of a basketball, and it would be 25,000 miles away. And, you know, you drive that far in your car over the years. So it's an enormous distance just to the nearest star. And that's to say nothing of, you know, the fact that we have a whole galaxy. We live in a galaxy with 100 billion stars in them. So the distances out there are truly enormous.
Help us understand how we measure distance when we are talking about those kind of distances. I guess I don't mean what kind of numbers do we use, but more how do we accurately determine distances that are so vast?
Well, what by parallax, by its 3D vision, really, we'll observe a star from one side of the Earth's orbit. 6 months later, the Earth moves to the other side of its orbit. We've learned from previous studies how big the Earth's orbit is. And so when you move 6 months away, the Earth moves to the other side of the sun, and you see that star from a different point of view. So against background stars, it shifts slightly. It's just like the 3D vision that you used in Avatar to see the things in the foreground or in the background. So we can see that the nearby stars figure out how far away they are, and we found that that they're on the scale that I talked about. If the sun's about 500 feet away, the nearest star would be about 25,000 miles away. That's how we discovered that.
As you discuss some of the more familiar heavenly bodies in the sky, you made a point that I had never really stopped to think about, which is the fact that when we look up in the sky, the sun and the moon appear to be almost exactly the same size. I mean, to our unaided eye. And of course, they are vastly dissimilar in their actual size, but almost identical in size and how they appear to us. It just made me realize how confusing that had to be for early man. And it probably led to centuries of a great misunderstanding about the nature of the sun and the moon. that's, I suppose, just sheer coincidence that they appear to be nearly identical in the sky.
That's fairly pretty much sheer coincidence. The size of the sun in apparent size, it's about half a degree, is pretty much determined by the fact that the Earth should have a reasonable temperature, that water shouldn't boil or freeze in the oceans. And if the sun were like twice as big in apparent size in the sky, the oceans would boil because it'd be like having four suns up in the sky if the sun were twice as big. So if the sun were twice as far away, and only a quarter of a degree across in the sky, then the oceans would all freeze, and we'd be so for the Earth to be habitable, the sun has to be pretty much the size it is. The moon, being the size it is, produces tides that are kind of reasonable, and that can help your amphibians get onto the land, maybe. So the moon, being the size it is actually a little bit helpful to life as well. But as you say, this was confusing to people. Aristarchus was the first one that really figured out that the sun must be much further away than the moon. The first quarter moon and the last quarter moon, these are the phases of the moon. New moon, first quarter, full moon, last quarter, new moon again. These are separated by 1 week each. And so they're equally spaced around the moon's orbit. And the first quarter moon is when it's half illuminated by the sun. And so he could figure out that if this was the way the moon was being illuminated in its orbit, the sun had to be much further away than the size of the moon's orbit. If the sun were only twice as far away as the moon, then that space between first and last quarter would only take up a third of the month instead of a half a month. So by geometric reasoning, he figured out that the sun was much further away than the moon, and therefore much bigger than the moon. And he could see that the Earth was about three times the size of the moon, because he could see the Earth's shadow on the moon during a total lunar eclipse of the moon. And so he was able to deduce that the sun was bigger than the Earth, and therefore he thought that the Earth should go around the sun rather than the other way around. And so people didn't believe him, and because they didn't believe him, it took till Copernicus, about 1,700 years later, until we were finally convinced. So people could have figured this out in the ancient Greek days if they were just a tiny bit smarter.
Or a little more open to what...
As smart as Aristarchus.
Right, or been a little more open to what on the surface had to seem like a preposterous idea. I want to ask you about something that I think is really important for all that we find in this book, and that is taken up early on in what you title The Shape of the Sky. This is a point in the book in which you are really trying to help us sort of unleash ourselves from a view of how our galaxy and our universe are shaped that is too constrained in order to really take in its full magnificence. Help us understand what we need to do to really grasp the shape of the sky, as you put it.
Well, when you go out at night in dark sight, you can see the sky overhead. It looks like a dome overhead, and the Earth looks flat, and it goes out to the horizon like a plate. And there's a dome overhead. That's a hemisphere. That's half of a sphere. But you can't see the rest of the sky because the Earth blocks your view. So if you imagine putting on a spacesuit and then imagine the Earth would disappear suddenly, you could see the rest of the sky, which is another hemisphere below you. You could see the sun. It's below the surface of the Earth, but just your view of it was blocked before. The sun is still there. It's just down below you. So if the Earth were to disappear, you would be surrounded by a complete sphere of stars. We call this the celestial sphere. And you could see the Milky Way going around in a circle around the sky. We live on a galaxy that looks like a dinner plate. We live in the plate. So if you look out in large distances, you're looking out in the plane of the plate. You see this band of stars, a faint band of stars going around the whole sky called the Milky Way. And the rest of the stars that you see scattered all over the sky, these are actually very close to us in the dinner plate. And these are the close stars, the bright stars. They're just as bright as the sun, in many cases brighter than the sun, but they're so far away that they look like tiny points of light. And this was realized only after Copernicus, but the ancient Greeks could have thought of that as well if they'd just been a little bit cleverer.
I'm reminded of a moment in one of the Star Trek motion pictures, the second one, The Wrath of Khan, where the Enterprise is confronted by another Federation ship that's been taken over by the villain of the movie, Khan, and they are both in a nebula where their sensors don't work, but what allows the Enterprise to outsmart Khan and the other ship is that they think spatially in every direction versus on a flat plane. And Khan, as he's flying this other ship around, is only thinking, in a sense, on that flat dinner plate, not up and down, which is the way when you watch the classic Star Trek TV series from the 60s, that's the only way we ever saw the Enterprise move was along this flat plane, as though there were a highway through space. And it's, in a sense, as we leap forward a couple of decades, the producers of Star Trek have made that same leap of understanding the galaxy as and the whole universe, for that matter, as this immense sphere rather than that flat dinner plate, which is usually how most of us envision all this.
Right. It's very important to think of the universe in three dimensions. I've studied galaxy clustering, and we found that there's a sponge-like connection of galaxies. The great clusters of galaxies are connected by filaments. It makes a sponge-like structure, and you really have to think in three dimensions to see that. And we find out there are great walls of galaxies connecting clusters of galaxies. Mario Urich and I discovered this, measured this Sloan Great Wall of galaxies, 1.37 billion light years across. And this is the largest structure in the universe. It got me in the Guinness Book of World Records, to my surprise. And it's a great record, too, because of all the records in the Guinness Book, there's the largest pickup truck, the largest pumpkin, you know, of all the largest things in the Guinness Book, we're the largest of the largest. So there's enormous structures out there, a chain of galaxies. These are all brought together by the action of gravity over the course of 13 billion years. And so thinking three-dimensionally rather than in a plane was very important for us to understand this cosmic web.
And you mentioned, again, back in that chapter called The Shape of the Sky, there are really only six human beings in history that have had the chance to actually take in the sky all at once, and that would be six Apollo astronauts.
Yes, these are Apollo astronauts that actually ventured outside their capsule to retrieve some experiments that were stored on the outside. They got a chance to look around the whole sky. The astronauts that are in the space shuttle, almost half their view is still blocked off by the Earth. They're in low Earth orbit, only a couple of hundred miles up. So they basically can only see half the sky just like we can on Earth. And the Apollo astronauts who were inside their capsules, they just got to look out a little bitty window. But if you actually went out of your capsule, you could see the whole sky, and you would see the Earth over there, and the moon over there, and the sun over there, and then all the stars surrounding you. So it's a view that only a few people have had.
Right. And in a sense, your book is an effort to give all of us that view, or at least help us grasp the notion of what that view might be like. I want you to have the opportunity to talk a moment about some of the beautiful photographs that are in your book that were taken in a surprisingly simple fashion in somebody's backyard. Tell us about where some of these wonderful, especially colorful photographs come from and how accessible these kind of photographs are to anybody who just happens to have the right equipment in their backyard.
Well, a number of the photographs in our book were taken by my co-author, Bob Vanderbilt, who's another professor at Princeton, but he's an amateur astronomer. And when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, starting to be interested in astronomy was really a backyard hobby. You could go out and see the moon, the planets. You could see the M31 galaxy, Andromeda galaxy. You could see nebulas. But what's happened over the years is light pollution has brightened the sky so that the faint objects like the galaxies and the nebula disappeared from view. But luckily, we've discovered astrophotography. We have CCD cameras now that are very sensitive, very much more sensitive than film. And we have filters so that you can filter out most of the light from the sky pollution and just look at one wavelength that the nebula might be emitting, hydrogen alpha light that's coming from a nebula. So Bob has been able to take pictures from his backyard that are astonishing, that rival the ones taken in the largest observatories. We have a picture in the book of the Eagle Nebula that Bob took from his backyard, and we put it side by side with the best picture of this from the Hubble Space Telescope. And you can see the Hubble Space Telescope picture's a bit sharper. Bob's has better colors because he's plotting it at the correct colors. The nebula really looks red, and the Hubble picture looks green because they're using a false color system to illustrate various scientific points. So it's amazing that someone from their backyard in New Jersey with a 10-inch diameter telescope can take a picture that would rival the Hubble Space Telescope. And if you want to take a picture of a planet, we now have the digital cameras allow us to take videos where we can take hundreds of pictures of this in a sequence, and then there's software programs that will pick out those moments of great scene where there's a moment of great clarity in the atmosphere and you can see the surface features better. It'll throw the bad pictures away automatically and add up the good pictures to give you really wonderful pictures of the planets. So we have in there a picture of Jupiter where you can see Jupiter's red spot. You can see the cloud layers in Jupiter. Bob has taken wonderful pictures of the planets and the moon. So we're hoping that this book, by showing off some of the beautiful pictures that you can take from your backyard, will encourage kids who love to take pictures with their digital cameras and put them on their computer, might be interested in taking up this as a hobby, because it's really become a backyard hobby once again.
It's very, very good. Spreads also that compare for us, for instance, the difference between Katrina and Jupiter's Great Red Spot, and the difference between the Grand Canyon and some of the features on Mars, and the difference between the United States and one single sunspot, helps us understand how small we are and how immense this universe is. The book, again, is called Sizing Up the Universe. And Dr. Richard Gott, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this beautiful book.
Thank you.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you're going to hear the interview which I recorded with Jessica Fellows. First of all, you should know that Jessica Fellows' uncle, Julian Fellows, is the gentleman responsible for creating the marvelous PBS television series Downton Abbey. And Jessica Fellows has written all of the official companion books to the television series. She has just written her very first novel, a very, very interesting work called The Mitford Murders, based actually on a British family that actually lived in the mid-20th century, and it's a series of sisters, I believe four in all, and Jessica Fellows is going to be writing a series of novels, each one focused on a different one of these well-known Mitford sisters. And this novel is a mystery, and it's beautifully crafted. And you'll be hearing my conversation with her on tomorrow's morning show. Also, I'll be speaking with the Racine County Treasurer about the matter of unclaimed funds and the means by which people can go about to see if they happen to be someone with unclaimed funds that they can claim as their own. So we'll have a couple of different interesting conversations on tomorrow's morning show. We remind you that the morning show airs every weekday.